Okay, so I'm talking to my long dear friend and co-lead of the Adams Event paper, Professor Chris Turney, University of New South Wales. Hello, Chris.
Hi, Alan. Isn't this fantastic?
It is. It's the brave new world. I'm in Adelaide, Australia, and Chris is in Sydney. So we're going to pretend that we're in the same room, but it's not actually true. So we've been working together for many years now, and the Adams Event story has really come about from studies we're doing originally on the extinction of megafauna in places like Europe and the Northern Hemisphere, where we detected something funny was going on in terms of periodic extinction events taking place. And that got us wondering about how we could measure changes in the environment accurately through time. Chris, what's your memory of how all this got going?
Yeah, it was that early work we did, didn't it? And looking at megafauna extinctions in the Arctic. And there were these clustering of dates. As you say, it got us thinking about, well, why might that be the case?
And I guess if we had to think of something that was about as far removed from the possibilities we were looking at, as you can imagine, it would have been geomagnetism, right? I mean, of all the things that we were contemplating might be involved in the extinction of megafauna and movement of human groups, the Earth's magnetic poles didn't really enter into it. And that's because geomagnetism has always been thought of as not having much of an impact biologically. And I presume that comes about partly because of earlier studies of the Le Champ event, the thing that we've been measuring 42,000 years ago, named after the small French village of Le Champ, where the volcanic action recorded the magnetic reversal because the iron containing or the magnetic molecules in the lava set into basalt facing the wrong direction. While that showed that 42,000 years ago, the poles had had a flirtation with turning upside down, the climatic records didn't really show anything particularly significant. That's more your area of expertise, but I believe it was the ice records in particular didn't show much, leading to people thinking magnetism probably didn't do very much. Is that roughly right?
Yeah, at one level, absolutely. So it's been known for a long time that you can drill through the ice sheets in Greenland, Antarctica, and you can go down up to several kilometres, actually, and these beautifully exquisite records of environmental change for these different parts of the world. And the gas bubbles trapped in the ice show what the atmosphere is doing. The ice layers themselves contain all these different measures, sometimes pollen grains, but different chemistry as well, reflecting the environmental climate changes in that region. And as you say, in Greenland, when you look at the ice that was laid down around 40 to 42,000 years ago, there's no immediately obvious record of environmental changes that appear to coincide with the Le Champ. And we can identify in the ice the Le Champ itself, because much like radiocarbon, another element that's formed in the upper atmosphere is something known as beryllium-10. And that snows out, rains or snows out over the ice sheets, and is laid down with all these other proxies in the ice. And so we can see this elevated level of beryllium-10 in the ice for the Le Champ, and we don't see any immediately obvious signal. And that's what basically set up a paradigm that perhaps actually these magnetic changes probably don't have much influence. But as we show in the paper, it's probably a little bit of actually hidden behind what's happening in the Atlantic climate. And I think that's a really interesting aspect from all of this. Actually, you've got one exquisitely detailed record of a regional change, in this case, of North Atlantic and over Greenland. And unfortunately, sometimes people, it's an easy shortcut to think, oh, that's the Northern Hemisphere or it's a global record. And I think one of the nice things we've done with our study is actually bring it together. And it's one part of a story, but if you look in the Pacific, you get quite a different story. And that's completely consistent with the idea that magnetic changes did have big environmental and climate changes. So fascinating whodunit of actually piecing all these different lines of evidence together.
One thing, can you remember the moment when we actually figured out that it must be magnetism was behind, was the thing that linked up all these events? I can remember us going round and round saying, it can't be. It surely can't be. Everyone knows it's not magnetism. It's really interesting trying to work out how we finally accept that it was geomagnetism, because dogma really suggests that geomagnetic change hasn't had much impact on the planet. And partly that was because studies of Lechamp have shown there didn't seem to be particularly marked shifts in things like the polar ice records. And if magnetism, and then because Lechamp was the most recent and the best known of the changes in the magnetic poles, surely that should have been the one that you could see climatic impacts if they were going to occur. And yet the polar ice didn't seem to show anything particularly marked, although as we kind of said in the study, actually once you've got the dating of Lechamp really precise, which is what the Kauri trees allowed us to do, you could in fact see that one of the background patterns of variation that's going on all the time in the North Atlantic did actually line up perfectly with Lechamp. And so, in fact, perhaps there had been a change that was measured, but it was hidden, perhaps in plain sight. And really, it was only through talking to experts in the ice field, in paleomagnetism and anthropology and archaeology, all of the team that we assembled that enabled us to look across all these different records that normally aren't compared, because a lot of the fields of science these days are so specialized, there's not a lot of time to compare notes.
But I think the other thing as well, which I think is actually critical, that because we had the Kauri trees and we have this extraordinary spike in radiocarbon when the magnetic field did collapse, that's like a time marker horizon. And as you say, we found all these different fields and all these dates started falling on precisely onto this spike. And I think for me, it was when we were looking, and it was particularly in the Southern Ocean, it was this site in the Auckland Islands, the Sub-Antarctic, which is a World Heritage area. And we were working with lovely people, Janet Wilmshurst and Matt McGlone, our good friends and colleagues, Landcare Research in New Zealand. And we'd been doing this work down there. And there is a precious new climate record that we found that dated to around this time. And it showed that just before the Lechamp and the Adams event, things were relatively warm down there. And then for tens of thousands of years after that, it became incredibly frigid and cold again as it went into the Ice Age and stayed that way. And I think for me, that's probably one of the points when actually I thought, oh, maybe we've actually got something really important here, because we did the dates all the way through, lots and lots of dates, consecutive dating and radiocarbon measurements all the way through that little snapshot of warmer conditions, and right at the moment that it ends and conditions just massively deteriorate, and implying the winds just disappeared and became icy and horrible and cold, aligned beautifully with the spike. And it was like, gosh, this is bang on the same time as the Lechamp. And it was suddenly like, this is hard to ignore. How do you explain that? It's getting a bit contrived to start saying, well, it can't be the cause, because the simplest explanation is obvious association implies there might be. And then, as you say, more and more we spoke to all our friends and colleagues and started putting these data sets together. They were all falling onto this spike, whereas before there'd been this big cloud of uncertainty or dating. And now suddenly it was like, actually, because of that big, pronounced, almost unique spike in the radiocarbon timescale, we could lock everything together within a couple of hundred years. And that's really strong, compelling evidence, I think.
Yeah, and I can remember conversations saying, it's 42 again, you know, whenever a new piece of data came in. I mean, what are the odds that 42 was Douglas Adams's favourite number? And yet our results kept coming up over and over again. I can remember asking you, 42, what is going on at 42? And you saying, well, there's Lechamp, but, you know, it can't be that. And you were right. That really did seem a completely nonsensical idea to try and relate magnetic change to the very real biological impacts that are going on all over. I mean, it was the megafauna in Australia, and why the extinction on the mainland 42,000 years ago happened to be almost identical to the extinction of megafauna in Tasmania, which was your work, your dating on the Tasmanian megafauna, because the mystery was that Tasmania had been an island right up until almost that point. And so if the Aboriginal populations who had been in Australia already for almost 10,000 years by that point had just got to Tasmania. Why would the extinction take place at the same time? And then why would that line up with things like the Giant Lakes and the centre of Australia disappearing? It just seemed like, as you say, coincidence upon coincidence. And wherever we could get precise dating on the timing, like your Auckland Island work, it was exactly the same as the Le Champ. And I think it was really just that overwhelming burden of evidence that was enough to tip us over to finally accepting, right, we're going to have to be heretical here and take on a completely new viewpoint. In that regard, what would you say was the most surprising result, the surprising aspect about the work, the thing you least expected when you started off?
For me, Alan, I think it was the fact that all these changes seemed to be happening about the same time. I mean, that for me was incredibly striking. Particularly for a lot of work that we've done in the past, you're often looking at sort of like things happening in the North Atlantic region being an antiphase of what's happening in the Southern Ocean, the so-called seesaw effect. You're looking for changes happening in one region, but at least in the Pacific Basin and some areas further afield, as we show in the paper, everything seemed to be locking together. And that was really quite surprising for me. I mean, I think the Cowrie record just provides this beautiful data set that allows, and I hope, I'm sure, hopefully, that a lot of the community are going to use this more and more. But I think also, actually, you know, reflecting on it more and reflecting back on what we found, you know, we had the Southern Ocean with Auckland Islands, and then we started working with Janelle Stevenson and James Russell, of course, and at Brown University. On this site called Lake Tawuti in the tropics in Sulawesi. And there, that's a tropical, a measure of the tropical rainbow. And there again, we did the same thing as the Auckland Islands did, a whole series of continuous radiocarbon measurements. And again, showed that the tropical rainbows shifted at precisely the same time as the Southern Ocean and this spike in radiocarbon. And I think then, really looking at that, maybe really. Mm. Possibly the biggest surprise to me was this idea that, oh, good grief, it switched into this different environmental state. And even though the magnetic field flipped back again, because we're back to where we were before Le Champ, with north being where we recognize as north, that brief period of all those extreme environmental changes was enough to shift the environment and the climate in some of these regions into a different state that lasted for millennia afterwards. I mean, it was going into an ice age anyway, the Earth's orbit around the sun, but it looks like that short, hard shock from the Champ with the climatic impacts that happened from that was enough to shift large parts of the Earth system into this other state that persisted for millennia. And I think that blew us away. It blew me away.
I can remember,
Wow.
I can remember you ringing up with the Sulawesi result and being so excited because it lined up just perfectly with the Auckland Island result, and you'd be convinced, okay, we now have the smoking gun, because the timing of these wind shifts in both the tropics and the Southern Ocean are exactly the same. And I suppose then, do you think it's our Pacific viewpoint, the fact that we had these sites and the ability to look around this part of the world that allowed us to find this in a way that if we were in the Northern Hemisphere, particularly Europe, using the North Atlantic records with the repeated climate cycles, shifts of glaciers, stadials and interstadials, cooling, warming, repeated events, do you think that might have hidden it? It was easier to see down here than if we were looking at those records?
Yeah, I think so, man. I think that's a very fair point, because I think the Atlantic overturning circulation system, the so-called conveyor belt that people are very familiar with, is a really dominant control on climate, particularly in the mid to high latitudes of the Northern Hemisphere in the Atlantic sector. And so that process seems to operate, and presumably is modulated by what's happening with Le Champ and that excursion, but that's a dominant signal, which is what's being found, as you say, in Greenland, with the stages into stages, warm into cold, warm conditions, is flicking off and on. Whereas in the Pacific, you don't have such clear evidence of that. So it's not such a dominant control. And I think the other thing as well is, particularly when you're looking you know, in lake cores and peat sediments and even marine cores drilled into the seabed, and people are looking at the marine sediments. If their records are along the coastal fringes of continents, in Europe in particular, you've got human activity and you've got modification of the landscape, which is influencing things like, or potentially influencing things like vegetation, which is preserved as pollen changes. Yeah,
good point.
Shows the vegetation. Mm-hmm. Whereas in the Pacific, particularly once you get down to the subantarctics, I mean, certainly humans were most definitely in Australia and Sulawesi, but one of the lovely things about the subantarctics was that you're in the Southern Ocean. No humans were there. And so you've got a clean signal. Any environmental change here is unique. It's independent of human activity. I think that does help enormously as well.
I think you're right. And I think that partly explains why this discovery is taken so long to come about. I think the Kauri work and the dating is a key element. But the fact that it hadn't really even been suspected before makes me wonder that, as you say, the seeing environmental records free of human influence really helped in terms of saying, well, it can't be humans. So the change at that point must be something else, must be environmental. What could it be? In which case, you know, maybe there's an argument for a lot more work down in the Southern Hemisphere, all these remote areas, to try and get at the precise nature of some of these events.
See, I think you're right. The Southern Hemisphere, and particularly remote locations, are incredibly valuable. Incredibly valuable for sort of getting a better picture of basically how we ended up where we are, how the world works, you know, and inevitably, because they're often remote, extreme environments, people don't tend to get there. And I think this work is just another example of where it's worth the effort. You can get some completely new insights.
I think so. And, you know, and we've got to keep in mind, therefore, the contrary view, which is that we have a very European-centric view of many of these processes, and that what we can do by looking at other places has come up with quite radically new interpretations of existing data just simply by looking at areas outside of Europe, which I think is something we often forget as scientists, is just how much the current knowledge is based on examples in that particular area, and how misleading that can be if you have compounding effects like humans invading Europe and changing the environment about the same type point in time as something like this taking place. So in terms of some of the people we've met along the way, I think we both agree that the most outstanding individual would have to be our solar physicist, Ken McCracken. How would you describe Ken and his role in all this?
Oh, Ken's been a revelation. Neither you or I really knew anything about cosmic rays to that level. And so I'll never forget the meeting you and I had when we drove up to see Ken. I mean, here's this 87-year-old giant in the science who's a complete gentleman. He's extraordinary. And well, I remember saying to you afterwards, we had the most intellectually amazing meeting, bouncing ideas with him and talking about, look, does this make even sense, what we are seeing as association? Is there actually some physical mechanisms that can actually explain this? And Ken didn't laugh at us, and actually then immediately pivoted and started laying out reasons how this could actually work. I remember when we left after a few hours, and I was just absolutely done in. I was exhausted with all these ideas. I'm always playing catch up. So you always say it's incredibly humbling, and it's one of the privileges and pleasures of this business, isn't it? You meet these amazing people who are just so generous of their time and are willing to give you the time of day to explore ideas. I think that's one of the lovely things about science, is actually being able to put things together in this amazing jigsaw puzzle, seeing if you can even just solve one, put one small part in, and actually say, I've made a small contribution. And it's absolutely just amazing how many credible people are out there who are willing to do that.
I think you're right. I mean, it does really feel like, in this case, we've put a whole bunch of the jigsaw puzzle together in one go, using the knowledge of people like Ken. Here's a guy who was designing the equipment for the Pioneer series of satellites, some of the first satellites put up into space, which were recording cosmic radiation from around the sun and various other parts of the solar system. He was designing and putting the stuff up in the 60s. And here we are talking to him now as an expert on solar physics, him teaching us Geomagnetism and Solar Physics 101. It was a huge privilege.
Yeah, I remember when you dropped me a message and Ken had emailed back and it mentioned it, we were now going to draw on the Voyager data for the edge of the solar system. And the Voyager was launched when I was born. So here's this amazing data set. I mean, it's decades in the making, this story, for sure.
No, exactly right. And what Ken was doing was using the readings that the Voyager satellite got as it left the solar system and started measuring the cosmic radiation from the galactic cosmic radiation, the stuff that's happening outside. It's trying to get into our solar system, but the sun's solar wind carrying the magnetic field from the sun actually blocks that radiation. And so normally we can't measure it. But, of course, when the sun goes into a major quiet spell, as we think took place during the Lechomp event, that background radiation penetrates much further into the solar system. So we really needed a reading on that. And Ken, of course, had designed the experiments that went out and measured it. And so here we are as two biologists using information from outside the solar system as a parameter in our models. I mean, I'd never thought that would happen. That was quite remarkable. No. And Ken's generosity as well, when we sat down with him and said, look, this is what we think has happened. Lechomp occurred, the magnetic field turned off, ionizing radiation may have come in, and things happened all over the planet as a result. And he said, huh, we spent all this time back in the 60s trying to work out what would happen to astronauts when they went out into space beyond the protection of the Earth's magnetic field and were subject to this cosmic ionizing radiation. And we never thought that the experiment might have actually already been done on Earth. This is very interesting indeed.
And I always remember that conversation.
Yeah. Here he is telling us this. This is a guy putting satellites into space, telling us that we've got a really interesting idea that could inform them of important principles. It's a huge honor.
Absolutely.
And I guess that kind of shows the bigger picture nature of all this. What are your thoughts about the bigger picture of what we've discovered? And I'll talk about mine from a evolutionary perspective. How about from your side of science? What do you think?
So I think from my perspective, to me, this is just yet another example of the benefits of multidisciplinary research, bringing these amazing people together and finding people willing to bounce ideas. And this is I think this is the most exciting thing I've ever been involved in as a scientist.
Yeah, same.
You and I have been very fortunate to publish in Nature and Science journals before, but I think this is by far.
Absolutely.
A lot of science that we do is pretty incremental, generally speaking, and science has to work like that. It's not often one gets to sort of play with a really big picture and say, oh, this kind of makes sense. It'd be interesting to see what everyone else thinks. I think this is one of those stories where you think, well, it's a really interesting idea. Maybe there's another way of interpreting a data, but we think this is a reasonable interpretation. And for me, you know, actually having, I mean, Ken is amazing, and there are lots of other incredible researchers that we've had a privilege to work with on this, who have given us the time of day and bounced ideas and gave some really amazing input, creating this study that we've published in Science. And I think it's incredible to show that actually, if you can get people together and give them the time to think, you can start coming up with some really interesting concepts. And from a climatic point of view, the fact that you can have these major changes at these abrupt sort of we talk about geological events, but they're not really geological. We're talking something that's happening relatively quickly and persisted. I mean, as you were saying, you know, this is during the Lechomp, it's a reversal of the poles, a transition from north going to south and south going to north, which took place about 800 years. That's the time when the Earth's magnetic field was at its weakest, you know, less than 6% of what it is today. And that was enough to open up the Earth's magnetic shield, the door, basically, to all these cosmic rays. And in combination with the solar wind being so much weaker, so the magnetic field from the sun also being weaker, so it's not deflecting cosmic rays. So the door was flung wide open. And all these high-energy particles coming in and dramatically changing the chemistry of the atmosphere, which in turn had climatic impacts similar akin to the ozone hole today, which is having dramatic climate effects. Which is a revelation. It was a really interesting thing to see. Oh my gosh, there's a perfectly reasonable explanation for why these changes might have been. In fact, it's very hard to actually argue why that wouldn't have occurred.
Good point.
Yeah, I suppose the key point there is, and that people might not know, is that the ozone hole created in the 1970s through the use of CFCs caused quite marked climate shifts, which we can still measure today, the cooling impacts of that ozone hole. So in comparison, the massive decrease, 10 to 15% reduction in ozone levels we calculate for the La Chambre, would have caused far greater climatic shifts.
Ionizing radiation hitting the upper atmosphere, you do expect to see damage of ozone and differential heating impacts across the atmosphere from the sun, all of which is going to massively change climate. And the idea it'd be
very hard to argue why it wouldn't have done. You're absolutely right.
Yeah.
And of course, one of the most pronounced things we find in the paper, which we probably should mention, given the fact we sort of alluded to this a little bit, is the fact that actually one of the biggest changes actually happens over North America and a weakening of the Arctic vortex during wintertime. And basically when the east coast of the North America gets really cold because you get this Arctic air just being surging out across the eastern states. And what we call a negative Arctic oscillation. And that happens today, but basically our models, the model simulations led by the great team at ETH Zurich, looked at this. We could see this really significant, massive impact upon that area, which is exactly where the North American ice sheet, the Laurentide ice sheet, grew up from. And we know that there wasn't much ice before 42. And then afterwards, it massively grew. When here you've got a situation where we know the ice sheet grew really quickly, and actually the climate chemistry modeling suggests a mechanism by which it could have grown really quickly, really, really cold winters. And of course, if you then suddenly grow a massive ice sheet over North America very, very quickly, that's going to also disrupt atmospheric circulation patterns. It's going to actually, because of the orbital change as well, moving into an ice age, is going to stay big. And effectively, that looks like a major reason why things like the tropical rain belts, winds over the Southern Ocean, basically stayed in those pronounced locations away from those islands for multiple millennia. Because once the La Chambre happened and that transition occurred, you grew the ice sheet, and that was enough to basically settle up and then basically kept at least the Pacific side in particular into this new state until its orbit returned to somewhere warm enough and it can melt. So it's a really interesting sort of perfect storm, isn't it? You've got a weaker magnetic field, you've got a weaker sun, and then on top of that, the Earth is heading towards an ice age. And this probably tipped it in a lot earlier in some sections of the world. Mm-hmm. Amazing.
Mm-hmm. No, and the point I was going to make about the bigger picture from my field kind of feeds off that, in the sense that from an evolutionary perspective, seeing what happens 42,000 years ago at La Chambre makes you immediately think, well, what about all the prior periods when the poles have reversed, either as smaller excursions, which are much harder to detect, and I suspect we've missed many of those that have occurred, or full reversals when the poles actually permanently switch place for a long period of time. Now, they're recorded all throughout the geological history, and yet I think the view of La Chambre has kind of coloured things a little bit, but in general, they're thought not to have much impact. Now, many of those events are much bigger. For example, the last reversal, the Brumadiana, around 800,000 years ago, that had a transition when the poles are trying to make up their minds which way they were going to be, that lasted 20,000 years in comparison, obviously, to our minor 1600 of the La Chambre. Now, that's a much bigger period of time with no magnetic field or limited magnetic field. The impacts would have been enormous. And we shouldn't really conclude, I guess, that either the Brumadiana or La Chambre are in any way large versions of this. There could be much, much bigger ones represented by those switches we see earlier on in geological time. And that makes me think, from an evolutionary perspective, we may have missed a major driver of marked environmental change that's taken place periodically through time, because these reversals in geological time happen reasonably common. I mean, they're not obviously regular, but they happen a lot more than large asteroids impacting the world, which is the other kind of recent discovery of ways in which you can change the planet in an unpredictable fashion. But all of that says that the Darwinian view of evolution, which is often simplified such that the animals and plants and everything else is optimizing their traits to fit a certain sort of environment, that becomes very difficult, certainly to study and model, if the environment is changing all the time. Mm. If there's not one optimum you're heading towards because the environment has just changed due to a magnetic reversal, that really alters the way we look at the way that evolution has worked over large periods of evolutionary time. And maybe even some of the unexplained mass extinction events, the big five that have occurred through time, the last one being the, the sixth one being the one that humans are doing right now, obviously. But the dinosaur extinction 65 million years ago being the asteroid. Prior to that, the other mass extinctions still are a mystery. And one of them, at least, the Devonian, end-Devonian extinction, which is when we saw the vertebrates starting to take hold on land, and has evidence showing pollen grains that have been damaged by high levels of ultraviolet light. And people have started to wonder, how was UV involved in the Devonian mass extinctions? Clearly, it had a major impact, and the ozone layer must have been damaged. And a recent paper actually suggested it might all be the result of a nearby supernova going off. Unfortunately, there is no signal, really, that the astronomers have detected that would be compatible with that supernova and that point in time. But if you look at that evidence, that is a larger version exactly of what we have seen during Le Champ. So maybe we, and I think we are, really looking at a whole new evolutionary phenomenon that has been missed up until this point in time. And so this our small study, which has been so pleasing, might actually have much larger long-term impacts on understanding evolution on Earth and with climate.
Mm. That's fascinating. I didn't know that actually, for UV damage of the pollen grains from back then. That's fascinating. Mm. But of course, when we're saying about, you know, this the new insights, of course, we're fully aware, of course, that, you know, there was some really amazing pioneering work done back in the 70s. Where people were just starting to play with some of these ideas, and then it fell out of fashion, didn't it? And so you know, we feel like we're treading in the paths of greats who've gone before, and laid down some pointers for us.
It's a very good point, actually. I think this will be a lovely study in future about how science works, because what you say is true. If you go back and look in the late 60s and 70s, nature and science were carrying a number of papers saying, this magnetism thing might actually be having large impacts, might be impacting climate. We think, in fact, it does. And it became quite a theme at the time. I guess people were starting to get quite concerned about climate change. The impacts of anthropogenic gases were just starting to be felt. Nixon and co. were starting to get quite political about it. But it suddenly all stopped in the late 70s. I guess American politics changed at the same time, which may not be a coincidence. And then geomagnetism just dropped away as a driver for 30 years. Mm-hmm. And I think it really shows science is far more fashionable than many of us would like to admit in terms of what ideas get picked up and then supported, and how it's easy to publish something which is an incremental advance in an area that's already accepted. So people all think this is good and supportive versus coming in from left field. And I guess that's the way science works quite often, right? That you come along with a completely different idea, and the three steps are first that the field is not too receptive, because it challenges a whole bunch of accepted beliefs. Mm. And then there's a grudging acceptance that it might be true in special circumstances. And then finally, after a while, when it works all over the place, everybody says, "Oh, that's what I thought all along." And I think we're at the start of those three stages. So, one last closing point, maybe then. What's the most surprising or pleasing fact that you came up with during the study. Any thoughts on that?
Oh, wow, I got it. Yeah, it's such a big study. And then actually trying to look back and say how the most pleasing aspect of it. Look, if I'm honest, I think the fact that it's all come together, I think that's, that to me surprised me. I'm naturally a very skeptical person. I'm optimistic, as you know, ridiculously so sometimes. But with science, I'm always looking for, am I just trying to see this through the eye of faith? Am I just believing it? I'm always trying to question it. And
yes.
I think one of the things really I just loved from this was the fact that no matter what we threw at this with regards to, oh, this area would be a really important one if we could get a record from, you know, let's say Lake Sulawesi, you know, Lake Tuuruti and Sulawesi. That would be a good test to see if this idea is right. And sure enough, it worked, you know. When we started looking at the climate model simulations and then found that, oh my gosh, if we're going to have to, we have to grow the North American ice sheets to actually force this long-term change. And good grief, look, it was absolutely jaw-dropping. It was the biggest signal of a lot out of all the simulation outputs. That was the region which was most sensitive, according to our models. And the fact that everything kept falling in line, it was just, it was that almost bigger philosophical point, really, that actually it all just seemed to work together.
It did feel that way, didn't it? It just kept growing. Every time it could have gone one way, it could have fallen over, it didn't. It just kept reinforcing and growing. And it did feel like a philosophical, like you were discovering something that was really there and you were just brushing the dust off the top of this picture. And it never failed to get more and more coherent and believable.
Well, and actually, listeners, the paper is quite large in science, but if people dare... the supplementary material is a beast. It's a weighty tome. Yes. It's extraordinary.
You're not selling it. You're not selling it.
I know. It's not quite as bad as War and Peace, but it's a big one.
No.
And it's substantial. And it's testament to just how much works. And as you say, I just feel we've just touched the tip of the iceberg on this.
Yes,
I think so. You could have put so much more supplementary material, and I'm sure there'll be a lot of other studies. Some hopefully we will do, but I'm sure hopefully others will look at it as well. But the supplementary material has a wealth of information there. And it, again, just underpinning just how much is involved to get a study of this sort of magnitude together. I would also say, actually, I think one other thing I think actually is rather lovely about this, putting aside the multidisciplinary nature, is the fact that there's a big push at the moment for strategic research funding, and we basically funded this primarily through a Blue Skies research scheme called the Discovery Project, funded by the Australian Research Council. It's Blue Skies. No one was asking us to look at this, and we didn't know we were going to find this. We were just curious to know what was happening around this time. And this is what resulted. And I think that's a really interesting point about the fact that, you know, there's a lot of thing about getting value for money out of science, and that certainly is incredibly important. But we shouldn't lose sight of the fact that actually some blue sky science will work and others won't. And the ones that do should outweigh the ones that don't. I think this one's a lovely example of something that actually turned up completely unexpected, really.
Yeah, I think it's a very good point you make, and the other thing about that is it's really only possible to make discoveries of this kind of nature, this unexpected, with the blue skies approaches, or they are by far the better way to do it. Targeted research is going to end up with the results that you want and desire and are targeted at. You've got to already know what the answer is by targeting it to some degree, and the blue sky stuff like this is really where the big major unexpected leaps are made, because you didn't really know what you're going to find in the first place. And yes, I think it is a prime example of that. Returning to the previous point, I guess the most pleasing fact or surprising fact to me in the study, and there's been a large number of them, was when I was showing my son Torin the images of the cave art. I was working through the cave art ideas at the time and how they might relate to human sheltering from the ultraviolet and the ionization, lightning strikes and stuff. And I was showing him a picture of the handprints, the ochre negative, the outline of a hand with a red ochre blast around it on cave walls. And I was asking them, so what is this? Why are they doing that? And struggling over the art. And he looked at it and he said, I think sunscreen. And that moment, people had said it previously, and I must have read it. But at that, I'd completely forgotten it until that point. And that lightning bulb moment going off, of course, they'd need sunscreen. I'm sure I've read somewhere, and a quick Google, yep, the Namibian hunter-gatherers and other indigenous groups to this day use red ochre exactly in that way and apply it by blowing it onto their hands, which leaves a negative image behind. Suddenly just it crystallized exactly what they were doing and why these handprints were so common across the art left behind by that human movement across Eurasia, from Spain and Italy all the way across to Australia, suddenly bursting onto the scene and leaving that motif of the red ochre handprint, like a cancer campaign warning. And it may well be, you know, it becomes a common motif over time. Maybe once it was established, we're doing this before we go outside, became something that other people copied down through time, and it became a more of an established technique. But talking to our good colleague Leslie Van Gelder about the thinking behind those handprints and why they're so common, within archaeology, it's often considered to be a sign of a person. It's like graffiti saying, I am here, this is me. Mm. And as she says, well, if you're going to do that, by far the easiest way is to coat your hand in ochre or whatever you're going to use, charcoal, and then just place it on the wall, leaving behind a positive handprint. To actually go to all the trouble of trying to come up with a way of leaving behind a negative handprint, the outline of your hand, because it's blocked all the ochre and taken that away and left behind all the extra stuff, that's a very, very difficult way to make a handprint. If you just wanted to say, this is me, I am here, you don't go to all that trouble. And I think that is just lovely how these unexplained questions have suddenly all lined up so beautifully, like ducks in a row, once we started realizing what environmental changes might be behind all this and why magnetism might be causing it. Anyway, this has been wonderful. Thank you so much for taking the time.
No, it's been great chatting, mate, reflecting on it all. It's fascinating.
We now need to work out what happens with other geomagnetic changes that we know of in the last 60,000 years. That's the next project.
All right. Thanks, Chris.
Thanks, you take care, mate.
And next up in terms of the podcast will be Solar Physics 101 and geomagnetism with Ken Rakraken, who was our guide and expert in this space, formerly of NASA. And I hope you can join me for the next in the series. Cheers.